You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Well, morning, Sam. Like a bad luck planet in today's horoscope.
Over the course of 7 features, director Paul Thomas Anderson has built up a reputation for himself as one of the finest filmmakers of his generation. It's symptomatic of Hollywood's current priorities, then, that even a director as lauded and widely esteemed as Anderson has a difficult time getting a film made. After finishing his 2007 masterpiece There Will Be Blood, Anderson struggled for several years to get his follow-up, The Master, off the ground. This time away from production allowed him to develop several projects simultaneously, one of which was Inherent Vice, the first novel from cult crime novelist Thomas Pynchon to ever be adapted to the screen. While The Master and Inherent Vice were developed nearly simultaneously, the two works couldn't be more different from each other. With the benefit of hindsight, this result could be seen as the middle-aged director passing into a new stage of his career, one that's still yet to crystallize into an easily identifiable set of thematic ideas, but seems to swap the stately gravitas and classical formalism of his two previous features for the delirium of eccentric dramaturgy, chaotic unpredictability, and technical improvisation. Inherent Vice marks Anderson's return to the studio fold after the independent production and distribution of The Master, but even the increased firepower afforded by Warner Brothers' backing wasn't enough to save the film from its own labyrinthine plotting and an ambivalent audience reception. The plot to Inherent Vice is, in a word, incomprehensible. The story's various twists and turns are densely layered, and delivered almost entirely in stoner mumble and hippie slang. Multiple viewings aren't encouraged, they're mandatory, in order to fully untangle the sea of knots that Anderson has woven here. It's important to note, then, that this is not a simple case of directorial overindulgence. In presenting Inherent Vice in this way, Anderson has faithfully captured Pynchon's idiosyncratic voice and spirit right down to the letter. Going by the film's definition, Inherent Vice is a shipping term that describes an item whose decay is an inevitable product of its own internal components, rather than external forces. Milk will spoil, and chocolate will melt. In the film, Doc wonders what the term means when it's applied to ex-girlfriends. We can infer, then, that Inherent Vice is the primary agent responsible for the breakdown of our romantic relationships. Our weaknesses and self-indulgence cause us to deteriorate from the inside, keeping us from arriving at our destination in a pristine state. Anderson's approach to Inherent Vice suggests that the film, then, is really about the flower power generation's internal degenerative agents and their attempts to keep their particular way of life alive in the face of a new conservatism embodied by figures like Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush.
Can't stay out here long. This is Golden Fang territory, and a girl don't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks.
What is it? A band?
Oh, you wish.
In his second consecutive performance for Anderson, controversial leading man Joaquin Phoenix fully embodies Pynchon's eccentric protagonist Doc Sportillo, a stoner burnout turned private investigator.
Dr. Rudy, I'm back.
You're not Dr. Rudy.
You're not Dr. Rudy.
Anderson originally wrote the role with Robert Downey Jr. in mind, but the extended development cycle, as well as his positive experience with Phoenix on The Master, caused him to reconsider. Indeed, Phoenix's own eccentric charisma makes him a no-brainer for the role, allowing him to disappear entirely inside Sportello's signature mutton chops and Birkenstocks.
Did I miss an episode? I love you guys every Sunday night, 8 p.m.
A burnt-out hippie in the grand tradition of the Big Lebowski, Sportello is a relic of a bygone age that won't recognize that its time has passed. Phoenix charmingly mumbles his way through Anderson's idiosyncratic caper, but years of heavy drug use have done little to dull Sportello's investigative edge.
Look, I've been referred to more than one time by the LA Times as a Renaissance detective, okay? Which means I am many things. One thing I am not is stupid. So purely out of noblesse oblige, I extend this assumption to cover you.
Josh Brolin's lieutenant, Christian Bigfoot Bjornsson, is almost the exact opposite. A sharp-witted lawman with a particularly blunt approach to justice.
So perhaps, Sportello, you can help forestall this by providing the names of the other members of your cult.
Cult?
No one would ever be stupid enough to attempt this alone, which suggests some kind of Mansonoid conspiracy, wouldn't you agree?
No.
Brolin is effortlessly convincing, as the lantern-jawed ideal of Eisenhower-era masculinity.
Choto! Kinichiro! Dozo! Moto Panakeku! Moto Panakeku! Moto Panakeku!
Lieutenant Bjornsson's ironclad resoluteness is a fantastic foil to Sportello's squirrely paranoia, creating a truly entertaining chemistry that fuels the film's sense of momentum.
Day off.
It's Sportello.
Oh, Sportello. Doc Sportello. The Doc Sportello. So, we meet at last. Mr. Moral fucking Turpitude himself. Have you any idea of the therapist bills around here for which you are directly responsible?
The department picks up just a little.
Oh, the department? Yeah, after a deductible that would choke a fucking horse.
He called me.
In the absence of a true singular villain for Sportello and Bjornsson to track down, the story compensates by focusing instead on the titanic battle of wills between these two characters, each man embodying the ideals of their respective eras, and hell-bent on staying afloat amidst the tumultuous sea of change that threatens to drown them. A rogues gallery of oddballs and eccentrics populate Anderson's supporting cast, most of whom are working with the director for the first time here.
I need your help, Doc.
As Doc's ex-lover Shasta, Catherine Waterston is presented to the audience in a manner not unlike a spiritual vision. She's a ghost, drifting in and out of Doc's life without warning, bewitching him with her perpetual pout. Already a growing presence within the independent scene, Waterston delivers a breakout performance that lingers in the mind, infecting the audience's memory much in the same way she's infected Doc's.
Back when they were together, she could go weeks without anything more complicated than a pout. Now she was laying some heavy combination of face ingredients on Doc that he couldn't read at all.
Better known for her musical career as a singer and songwriter, Joanna Newsom lends her ethereal physicality to the film as Sortilege, a character whose purpose within the narrative is never fully explained.
Okay, Doc, you have what looks to be a 20-kilo inconvenience in your trunk, and Bigfoot no doubt putting out word to that effect. And once again, you're the bait.
She acts as something of an avatar for Pinchon himself, preserving his distinct prose in the form of on-screen narration.
Doc figured it might have been easier to let Coy know that Hope and Little Amethyst were doing just fine, but he had a rule against getting involved in matrimonials.
It's implied several times throughout that only Doc has the ability to see and interact with Sortilege, which suggests that she might be something of a guardian angel, a soothing voice to calm the paranoid storm raging in Doc's head.
So, what's the beef here exactly?
It doesn't have much to do with your specialty, which I understand is marine law.
We got plenty of crime on the high seas, Lieutenant.
Okay, well, so far we have murder and kidnapping. We can work in pirates if it would make you more comfortable.
Despite extremely limited screen time, Benicio del Toro makes a memorable impression as Sancho Smilax, an attorney specializing in marine law and a friendly confidant to Doc.
Well, according to Scuttlebutt, shortly before he disappeared, Mickey Wolfman was seen taking the Golden Fang out for a three-hour tour. Or should I say, a three-hour tour.
The same can be said of Owen Wilson in a subdued performance as Coy Harlingen, an ex-junkie musician who's been hiding out in the city's shadows after faking his death several years ago.
I'm supposed to be dead.
Well, there's also rumor that you're not.
It don't come as such great news, being dead as part of my job image, like what I do.
You're working for these people here at the club.
I don't know, maybe. It's where I pick up my paycheck.
Jenna Malone is quickly becoming one of the more interesting character actresses of her generation, as evidenced here by her turn as Coy's wife, Hope, another ex-junkie who found God, and a set of false chompers after becoming a mother.
Heroin sucks the calcium out of your body like a vampire. If you use it for any length of time, your teeth just go all to hell. And that's the good part.
Her recent dental work ends up as a vital clue in Sportello's investigation, linking her to Martin Short's demented, coke-hoovering dentist, Dr. Rudy Blatnoid.
Why, you're another one of those hippie dope fiends, aren't you? My goodness me. Here for a little perking up, are we?
Blatnoid is a member of the Golden Fang, the shadowy crime syndicate that's seemingly behind this whole mess. Reese Witherspoon plays Deputy District Attorney Penny Kimball, Doc's current lover and a strong-willed, independent woman in her own right.
Bjornson seems to think you're as good a suspect as any.
Seems to? Wait a minute, you've been talking to Bigfoot about me?
Doc, please. Besides, maybe you did it.
Curiously, she's very much a manifestation of the establishment, an entity Doc has been battling all his life. This character trait leads to some gloriously off-kilter chemistry between her and Doc, and makes for some of the film's most memorable moments.
Would you be willing to let me depone you?
Sure would.
You would?
What is it?
You, me, a tape machine, maybe another DDA to witness it?
Eric Roberts, also known as the man who will act in anything, displays formidable control of his craft in his brief appearance as real estate mogul Michael Wolfman.
What are you doing here?
They're helping me. They're helping me wake up from my bad hippie dream.
The mysterious man at the center of this whole caper, Wolfman is initially presented in photographic form as a rich and successful businessman. However, when Doc tracks him down at a rehab facility outside of town, Wolfman is strung out and barely coherent, having been placed under the watchful eye of the feds and doped up beyond all recognition. Michael Williams, a rising talent with high-profile turns in The Wire and Boardwalk Empire, makes an amusing cameo as Tariq Khalil, who has just been released from prison, only to find his old neighborhood completely bulldozed to make way for one of Wolfman's planned suburban communities.
Old street gang, the Ortiz of Crips. See, when I came home from Chino, I went looking for them and found it ain't just them gone, but the whole damn turf itself.
What do you mean gone?
Man, I'm talking not there.
Finally, Saturday Night Live alum Maya Rudolph, Anderson's real-life partner and the mother of his children, appears briefly as Petunia Leeway, the secretary at Doc's office.
Oh, Shasta and Doc lived together for a short while.
Oh.
Inherent Vice is a film that often feels meandering and unfocused. The production process was politely described by Anderson's collaborators as chaotic. Most of the time, this would be a bad thing, but that isn't necessarily the case here. Indeed, Anderson's adherence to Pynchon's particular voice and his cavalier subversion, or outright disposal, of the genre's most recognizable tropes make for a singularly unique mystery film. The cinematography goes a long way towards conveying this notion, with Anderson's longtime director of photography Robert Elswit returning to head up the camera department after his absence from The Master. Having shot The Master in large format 65mm film, Anderson and Elswit return to the tried-and-true 35mm gauge, choosing a grainy stock that adds a slight veneer of granola crunchiness. Retaining The Master's 185:1 aspect ratio, Inherent Vice is presented as a gritty, sun-baked take on the traditional noir genre. Some have even gone so far as to call it a surf noir. The color palette deals in muted, faded tones that once were bright, a reflection of the harsh sobriety that followed the collapse of the chemically altered dreams of the 1960s. The lighting is bright and naturalistic, save for the nocturnal sequences, which take on a deep, almost theatrical cobalt hue. A filmmaker long known for his dynamic camera work, Anderson's recent output has seen a noticeable drawdown of flashy techniques in favor of classical discipline. Inherent Vice seemingly deviates from this laser-focused approach by shooting a substantial majority of setups handheld, yet it also reinforces Anderson's previous aesthetic conventions in a big way. The film plays like something of an amalgamation of his prior stylistic epochs. His early career fondness for extended tracking shots, as well as the current fascination with the compositional conceits of portraiture, are sometimes combined together, like in the long Steadicam shot that plays under the opening title. Many scenes are presented in extended master shots with little to no coverage, with his compositions accentuated by a slow, almost imperceptible forward tracking movement that's reminiscent of Stanley Kubrick's late career aesthetic. Anderson's foray into conceptual comedy in the years surrounding Punch Drunk Love also informs Inherent Vice, making for his most outright comedic effort in over a decade. There's a surprising amount of visual slapstick at work here, along with several playful visual gags, like a shot of his characters partaking in a pizza dinner party composed to recreate Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. Inherent Vice marks Anderson's first collaboration with a new production designer, David Crank. Having worked as an art director under legendary production designer Jack Fisk on Anderson's two previous features, Crank stepped up to the task when Fisk proved unavailable, most likely due to his commitments on Terrence Malick's Knight of Cups. Inherent Vice takes place in the 1970s that has yet to see the glittering disco balls depicted in Boogie Nights, so naturally the film's aesthetic hues closer to a late 60s feel. Crank's production design is realistic and low-key, projecting a modest and lived-in authenticity that never descends into camp or exaggeration.
Doc remembered dimly a story from long past, a rumor about a partner of Bigfoot's who'd been shot and killed a while back in the line of duty. And ever since then, the story went, Bigfoot had worked alone.
In his third consecutive collaboration with Anderson, Radiohead guitarist Johnny Greenwood proves himself an invaluable component of the director's mid-career aesthetic, much like John Bryan had been for Heart 8 through Punch Drunk Love. Greenwood is inherently suited towards Anderson's artistic quirks, enabling him to complement and elevate the footage into a higher, sometimes transcendent realm. For all his perceived imperfections, Inherent Vice's strongest suit is arguably Greenwood's original score. Romantic, mysterious, and avant-garde effort comprised of violins, oboes, and musical saws that harken back to the ornately orchestral cues of yesteryear.
As if looking for something he didn't want to find, it became clear as vodka you keep in the icebox that whatever the connection between the LAPD and Adrian Prussia, he might as well have been working for them as a contract killer.
Hey, before you leave, can I get a ride with you? This place is freaking me out.
Okay. Good evening, Larry Sportello, Stone Turntable Magazine.
While he doesn't lean on needle-dropped source tracks as much as he did in the first act of his career, Anderson nevertheless uses his lively period setting as an opportunity to employ some choice art rock and pop classics from the era. The most high-profile of these tracks is Can's Vitamin C, deployed as a luridly beckoning narrative agent during the film's opening sequences.
Did I see you down in a young girl's town with your mother in so much pain?
Artists like Neil Young and Sam Cooke also appear on a soundtrack that ably captures the eclectic vibe of vintage SoCal, a broadly diverse palette of crooning country ballads, funky R&B cuts, and psychedelic rock riffs.
What are you looking at?
Huh?
The music technically may be from the same era, but is a far cry from the bright and cheery pop tunes we heard in Boogie Nights.
Found some letters you wrote me this morning.
Something had been puzzling Doc now for a while. Namely, what exactly the fuck was with Bigfoot here?
Indeed, Inherent Vice's selection of cues highlights the darker, more paranoid aspects of the decade.
Yeah, she stuck her head in for a minute.
Mm-hmm. You feeling broken up?
Yeah, kind of weird seeing her again, you know?
I will stay with you if you'll stay with me. Set the fiddler to the drum.
Hey, Dennis. Dennis. I'm gonna go look around. You wanna wait in the car? Come in and cover my back.
I was gonna try to go find a pizza. Is that okay?
Throughout the film, Anderson recurringly utilizes an interesting musical technique that blurs the line between in-scene diegetic music and non-diegetic soundtrack. Oftentimes, someone will be listening to music within a scene, only for Anderson to then transition to the next beat by changing the acoustic dynamics of the track to reflect that it's now playing over the image.
See?
I know.
The effect is similar to Stream of Consciousness, a cascading flow of sound and image washing over us and carrying us through into the next moment. Though Inherent Vice may be a faithful adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's novel, there's so much overlap between the source material and PTA's core thematic conceits that the final product also reads as decidedly Andersonian.
Are you okay, brother?
I'm not your brother.
His recent explorations into the dynamics of power with There Will Be Blood and The Master is manifest in Inherent Vice via the ideological war being fought by Doc and Lieutenant Bjornsson. They have diametrically opposed outlooks on life, but they're flip sides of the same coin. They're both inclined to seek out the truth. As such, their animosity and one-upmanship ironically resembles mismatched buddy cop comedies, or the withering pettiness of sibling rivalries.
Miss Portello, she's gone.
She's out there, man.
Out there?
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, she's disappeared just like her boyfriend Mickey, and I thought maybe you'd think there was a connection. Maybe they took off together. Yeah, she's gone, man. Baby.
She's gone? She disappeared? What?
She went all groovy on us.
The off-kilter intimacies of non-blood familial relationships drive Anderson's characters throughout his filmography, with Inherent Vice's contribution being the major subplot that endeavors to reunite Coy Harlingen with his wife and child. Funnily enough, this subplot ultimately serves as the source of the film's climactic emotional catharsis in the absence of a tidy resolution to the film's primary plot.
Doctor, I think there's a problem with the couch in your office. And bring that bottle.
Bizarre, dysfunctional sexual encounters are another prominent component of Anderson's artistic aesthetic, a conceit that plays out in Inherent Vice via a visit to a secret massage parlor, pornographic neckties, and a love scene between Doc and Shasta that plays out with such a prolonged sense of suspense and anticipation that it would make even Sergio Leone blush. Perhaps the most significant aspect of Inherent Vice as it pertains to its place within Anderson's larger body of work is its engagement with California's distinct cultural heritage. Much like The Master explored how the Golden State's relaxed sense of independence made it a breeding ground for crackpot religious cults and delusional charlatans, Inherent Vice examines how the potent cocktail of mind-altering substances and alternative lifestyle explorations in the 1960s exploded into countless subcultures and communities. Indeed, more so than many other films in recent memory, Inherent Vice captures that particular blend of paranoia and unease that plagued LA's utopian communities in the wake of the Manson killings. The sunny LA cityscape has always been a colorful place, culturally speaking, and Inherent Vice bypasses the glitz of Hollywood or the glamour of Beverly Hills in favor of the Southland's drought-choked sprawl. Distinctly Californian characters like hippies, neo-Nazis, and cult leaders clash together in distinctly Californian locales like seaside coffee shops, rehabilitation facilities, and canyonside mansions. As his filmography has grown, it's becoming more evident that Anderson has achieved something remarkable. With the exception of Heart 8, The Golden State has served as a prominent connective tissue between all of his films. Just as much as the 20th century could be called the American century, so too could it reasonably be referred to as the Californian century, in that the state was an embodiment of the progressive ideals that drove American prosperity for much of the last 100 years. Anderson's films mostly take place in California, spanning a wide variety of time periods. The span is so wide, in fact, that nearly every decade of the 20th century, save for the 30s, is represented at some point in Anderson's work. There Will Be Blood covers the birth and growth of the state from the turn of the century to the late 20s. The post-war boom times of the 40s and 50s are the setting of The Master. Inherent Vice takes place in 1970, but is haunted by the spirit of the 60s. Boogie Nights' decadent excess spans both the late 1970s and the early 80s. Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love explore California's evolving sense of identity during the 90s and the turn of the new millennium. If you were to watch Anderson's output in chronological order according to their story's time periods, you'd come away with a weirdly alternate, yet comprehensive, history of the American century as seen through California's distinct perspective. Inherent Vice is the kind of film that's not easy to love. It takes multiple viewings to even understand its plot, let alone embrace the idiosyncratic quirks of Anderson's vision. When it premiered at the New York Film Festival to polarize reviews, word of mouth began to spread that Anderson had made an objectively bad film. Critics praised the performances of his cast, but they all pretty much agreed that the story was unsalvageable, an overindulgent failure. Box office receipts were consistent with this reaction, confirming Inherent Vice's cultural reputation as a huge misfire from one of our most treasured filmmakers. Any Oscar campaign plans were probably scaled back instantly. But even the mountain of disappointment that greeted the film upon its release couldn't stop it from earning Oscar nominations for Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Costume Design. The collective frustration with the film is very real. Most likely a reaction stemming from only one or two viewings at best. Snap judgments made by people who don't care to commit to untangling the film's myriad mysteries. Like so many films before it, Inherent Vice might simply be a victim of unrealistic expectations. After all, Anderson's two previous works were staggeringly confident and majestically executed. And if the director's rabid fanbase was expecting more of the same, they were bound to be sorely disappointed. Such expectations tend to deny filmmakers like Anderson their right as artists to grow and experiment. And anyone who expects their favorite artist to deliver the same thing again and again, like it's some kind of mechanized process, surely misses the entire point of art. Of course, Inherent Vice could also simply be a bad film. It ultimately comes down to individual taste. Just like the unattainable mystery at the center of the film, there'll probably never be a definitive critical consensus as to Inherent Vice's place in the cinematic landscape. If similar films like The Big Lebowski are any indication, it's not impossible to imagine the film slowly accumulating a cult appreciation as multiple viewings increasingly reveal the full scope of Anderson's irreverent vision. Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.